I'm Dean Newland, and welcome to the Business of Intuition, where I coach, facilitate, train, and speak on the hard science and meaningful experience of intuitive leadership in business, so you can make better decisions, forge real connections, and creatively solve problems to amplify your impact and simplify your life. Welcome to the Business of Intuition.
Imagine you've been a successful individual contributor at your company, or you've been a sole proprietor in your own business, and then your world changes. You've been promoted to lead a team, or you start hiring employees. I'm sure many of us can relate to both the excitement and the fear brought on by being a new leader. The playbook for new leaders almost always reads something like, figure it out as you go. But what if you knew these three things? One, there are fundamental unconscious mindsets that derail even the best of intentions. Two, we should expose those mindsets before taking on a new challenge where they can do less damage. And three, loyalty, ownership, and pride can happen quickly within a team when members collaborate on choosing a name for the team, not unlike the loyalty, ownership, and pride we have for our own favorite sports teams. If you were the new leader, how would knowing these three things change your playbook? My next guest on the Business of Intuition has these answers and a lot more. Chris Larson has over 20 years' experience as a coach, educator, and facilitator. In fact, he's also my Vice President of Learning and Development for Mission Facilitators International, where he works with organizations to provide customized engagements that elevate the capacities of their leaders and teams to create meaningful impact. Chris started his career as an industrial research and development chemist and has held director-level positions in two research universities and holds a master's degree in chemistry for the University of Oregon. He has dedicated the past 15 years to the examination and facilitation of leadership and professional development, and he holds a certificate in neuroscience from the Neuro Leadership Institute. Chris is a master at getting to the root cause of what creates and limits leadership and team success. He translates social cognitive neuroscience into practical, relevant, and useful tools. To Chris, all personal and business relationships grow and die one conversation or one connection at a time. Chris Larson. All right. So, Chris, I want to start off our interview on the Business of Intuition with this question. You have been in the middle between education and industry. You've been that transition, that conduit, if you will, with your students who then have worked with you and then gone on to jobs. So you've got a very unique perspective, sort of being in between these two different, very different, but very symbiotic types of industries. What have been your ahas from a learning perspective as you reflect back on your time between education and industry?
Yeah, great. Thanks for that question and thanks for having me. So there's two components to this. One is, if we listen to industry talk about emerging students, and it doesn't matter whether they're coming out of business schools, STEM disciplines, which is where my focus was with scientists and engineers, the number one skills gap is soft skills, right? It's the ability to navigate the social constructs. And so that became very clear to me early on in my when I left industry and went back to academia that I needed to address that. So as I straddle that those two worlds, ultimately what I'm trying to do is, no matter what the technical acumen is, how can I make them more successful at interacting with humans in all of these dynamic ways that exist in our professional worlds? And what I started realizing is, as I felt like I had a really good grasp of teaching the models and talking about how to, you know, go about networking and building rapport and working on teams and engaging in leadership and those types of things, there was always a group of students, this is also true of professionals, who weren't able to actualize it for some reason. And at first, I do what most people do, which is like, oh, well, they're just not trying really hard. But one of the great things about my experience there is I wasn't just a teacher, I was a coach. And it was in coaching sessions that I really got to dive in and go, what's going on here? And I realized that there were these fundamental barriers that they were struggling with within themselves or just in their understanding of sort of the social world that kept them from really accepting and adopting a lot of this learning and then using it and turning it into competency.
Let me call that out real quick if I could. I'm sorry for jumping in, but mm-hmm. just so we can keep tracking with you, because I know you've got so much here on this topic. So what I hear you say is that there may be a willingness to learn from an individual, and it's not that they're just lazy or that they aren't trying hard enough. There may be something that's preventing that. And I think that's what I'm hearing you say. Am I correct?
Absolutely.
So what are some of those fundamental common things that we might be bumping into that keep us from translating information into action?
Yeah, absolutely. So it turns out that it's either, so when I think about professional development, it's self-awareness, social agility, and then whatever you want to tie onto that. And so for them, what it is they've had experiences before then that may have trauma, or they may be experiencing something like imposter syndrome. They may have, you know, we all fear rejection. It's a fundamental reality of being humans. We are social creatures. But the nature and the flavors that we struggle with rejection are different for all of us. So how you really eschew rejection in one space, I might be really comfortable being rejected in that based on my experiences in my life up to that point. And so what I found out was I needed to unpack more of the fundamental human elements of this, the psychology, the neuroscience of what might be going on with these students and with these professionals. And what I found was, is there's these universal things that just kept coming up and up and up. And the aha for me was, okay, from a coaching standpoint, I can address them as they come up with individuals within a group. What would happen if I took those fundamentals and taught them up front and center before I teach them whatever they came into the room for? And so for about 10 years across two different universities, I got to spend my time doing these experiments, learning more about the neuroscience and the psychology, and then going, okay, and something as simple as resume writing, a person's inability to write an effective resume may have nothing to do with their lack of knowledge about resume writing, ability to have done stuff in the past. If it's to use imposter syndrome, which I already brought up, if they're struggling with imposter syndrome, it's literally an inability to internalize previous successes. So how can we have someone show up and go, this is who I am. I'm amazing. I've done all of these things in this document, if they don't believe it? And so as soon as I unpack imposter syndrome, they go, oh, wow. And then all of a sudden everybody else in the room goes, I feel the same way. It's this universal experience. Now we've named it, which is a really powerful thing. And now we can move on from that and go, it might show up. This is how we're going to manage it. Let's move forward now. And now we're diving into what we're there.
So I like what you're saying here. So is this another way or a cousin to defining what we maybe have heard in the past around mindset, that your mindset is really important in terms of your ability to learn or to act? Is this another way of defining mindset?
I think absolutely. So when we, you know, growth mindset is getting a lot of attention, and sure, rightly so. We know that we have plastic brains. And so I think it's mindset, but I also think it's just perception, right? It's the mindset to me is really, here's where I'm at. Do they have an accurate view of where they're at? And one of the things that silence and lack of awareness has for, say, something like imposter syndrome or our desire not to be rejected is somehow I'm uniquely broken. And then all of a sudden, when you unpack it,
I'm the only one.
All of a sudden, you know, there's 80% of the rest of the people in the room going, I feel exactly the same way. I'm glad we started talking about this. And what was magical about this was, so we might be unpacking this thing, this one concept for a specific situation, but now that they know this fundamental first principle aspect of human beings, that comes with them. So now when it's, I just got a promotion, but I remember imposter syndrome is this thing. And I remember thinking, oh, no, they're going to find me out and I'm going to fail and everything's going to be miserable and I'm going to get kicked out. I've been here before. So in a sense, what's so like gooey for me as a coach and a facilitator and as an educator is I'm changing their life because that fundamental knowledge comes with them and it gives them the coping strategies they need to be successful. More than that, they can now also start to recognize these things in other people and thinking through how are they going to help influence these people and help these people be successful, knowing that and bridging those chasms. And so, you know, we brought up one thing like imposter syndrome, but there are dozens and dozens.
What I really just find fascinating about what you just shared is that, and I'm just repeating back, but I really want to land this one. You coach somebody, you're a new leader, you've got a person on your team, you put them to work. Oh, they start to have issues with the execution of that work. Problems start to show up. And then we deal with what those problems are if we're smart and we have the ability to get really deep into what's going on with that person. That's what coaching is about. Mm-hmm. What some good leaders will do is like, what's underneath all this? Why are you having a hard time with this, right? If we have that sensitivity. What you're suggesting is let's reverse the order. Let's start off with what are the fundamental barriers that you may have, imposter syndrome being one, and let's talk about that. Let's see where everybody else is in the room. Oh, I have that too. I understand that too. Now we have community around. I'm not the only one. And then when we put people into a work situation where they're trying to actually get something done, they are already aware that this barrier may be coming up and they're being given skills to be able to remove them. Fair enough? Am I kind of summarizing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, no matter what you do, your business is people. It's all, these are all social constructs. And so I think, you know, if whether you're an accountant or a plumber, the barriers usually they're not technical. We don't have a good model for this. There's not enough books written on the topic. It's really, we're missing the first principles. We're missing the fundamentals. And as a trained scientist, for me, I was like, this problem just keeps persisting in all of these different ways. What's going on there? And for me, what I found was these foundations. And so when I started incorporating that front and center as the building block for the thing, which I call integrated professional development, it was just transformative. The capacity of the people interacting with that just went up across the board. But some other magical things happened. They felt more confident. They felt more empowered, and they felt more connected to each other. And so we got to start with the human. We got to start with the human side of it before we get to all of the business structures that that they're navigating.
Tell me how you read on this one, Chris, but I would assume that a person sort of knows that they have barriers in anything that they do, whether it be home or work or what have you. And maybe the sheer grit of just getting something done is what drives them forward, but they sort of know that there's some skeletons, you know, in their past, that there's some concerns that maybe they haven't dealt with, but they want to keep at bay. But what you're sort of saying is let's pull that out. Let's get out that other front and let's talk about that first. And then let's put you into the situation. So I have a couple questions here. In your model that you're describing here, are there, and you call them first principles, I think is what you said. You've had some words to describe. Is there a list, common list of these barriers that you see in industry and education that one could look at and teach on and coach on, again, prior to the work actually happening? Is there a common list? Is it 10? Is it 15? Is it 100?
So, you know, I think if I do this for another couple hundred years, I'll start to be able to tell you how long that list is. You know, I'm a classically trained chemist that now has spent the last 15 years really just swimming in the sea of psychology and social cognitive neuroscience. So I'm definitely not the expert. Having said that, you know, there's certain things that I come back to over and over again. And fundamentally, the list is really short because the header on top of the list is humans are social creatures, our business is people. And so ultimately it's what's in the way. So when I design a learning engagement, whether it's training, whether I'm actually doing coaching intake, some of the times that I actually want to filter for these skeletons, as you call it. And I just ask, what are the likely barriers from this list that will show up? And so there are some that come in big time. One is emotion regulation.
Emotion regulation?
Yeah. So oftentimes we're in a meeting, we're having a conversation, and the only regulatory, assuming we can regulate our emotions, the only regulatory tool we use is suppression. I'm going to sit here and whatever I'm feeling, I don't feel safe. It's not appropriate for it to come out. Oftentimes that's because there's another problem, which is about trust. And I'm just going to suppress it. Right. So it's really important maybe to teach what's going on there and how toxic that is for you as a living system, as well as how it actually doesn't progress, doesn't make you more successful in any way with that relationship and with that work. And maybe learning that just being able to label the emotion in the moment, I'm feeling it, I'm going to suppress it. But instead of just suppressing it, I'm going to go, I don't know, I feel lonely in this. I'm feeling left out. Just by labeling it, It actually reduces the limbic response in our brain, and our prefrontal cortex starts coming on.
Up in the middle of a meeting and say, "Hey, guess what, guys? I feel left out. This would be something that I would do internally myself."
That's right.
Okay.
So just labeling emotions actually starts to lower the limbic response. And ultimately what your limbic system's there to do is look for salient information that's out of whack, right? It's basically your threat detectors. And so when you're feeling threatened in some way, and there's a great model for this that came out of the neuroleadership, which I'll mention in a second, then all of a sudden the limbic system goes on and it starts going into hyper-monitoring mode, like what's going on? Shut it down. You need to, you know, in a sense, it's a freeze mode because you're like, don't show emotion. And by just going, hey, I know what this is. I think it's these emotions. By labeling it, you're in a sense, you're kind of tricking your limbic system to go, don't worry. We know what's going on now. We can come offline from red alert and we can start to bring back the higher order functioning of our brain and be active. So that's a really simple one that I brought up, but how often are we in that situation where
all the time,
you know, we right. swallow it.
Well,
and this little tweak, how long did it take us to cover this? So imagine doing that with a group of people and being like, just put a name to it. You will not be triggered by it again in the future as much. And it will lower in the moment.
It sounds like something we picked up. You get these little phrases in your industry and in our coaching industry. We have one that I've heard for years, which is whatever you resist persists. And I think what you're sort of saying in another way is if we resist this idea that I'm feeling lonely in this situation, it just persists. And if we become sort of stuck in that, but if we actually name it and feel it and go, hey, I guess I am feeling left out and not connected to these people, we sort of embrace that feeling. We've embraced it. Again, I'm not necessarily saying that we would call it out in the middle of the meeting. It may not be appropriate to that situation. So you mentioned a model that you wanted to talk about. I know which one you're talking about because we've had these conversations before, but would you kind of briefly tell us what that is? And then I got a question when I want to throw at you regarding a kind of a scenario that we could kind of unpack.
Sure. So the model I was mentioning is, I mentioned earlier this idea of our fear of rejection. So we are social creatures. We have a foundational need to belong and to feel like we're accepted as well as valued. That's fundamental. In fact, you know, the neuroscience is showing that Maslow's model is a little bit upside down. We will choose sometimes social over biological needs, right? Often. In fact, I don't know that you can get your biological needs if you're a social creature without the social. David Rock at the Neuroleadership Institute came up with a model for kind of, you know, okay, fear of rejection, that's a... right? That's a huge space.
Right.
So he came up with a model, an acronym called SCARF, which stands for status, certainty, autonomy, relatedness, and fairness. And in a sense, these are the five domains that you can think of threat or reward responses. And so I love the simplicity of this model, and I love that it gives some more texture in terms of these different buckets. But the model basically says this: your brain's job is to sort threat from reward. And that's happening subconsciously at an incredibly rapid rate. We have way more threat detectors than we have reward detectors. And that makes sense from evolution. You want to know that there's a saber-toothed tiger far before you would want to know like, hey, maybe there's honey up in the tree and that would be sweet. And so ultimately when we're having within social situations, which again is our life, we can experience threat and rewards within each of these domains. And so just to go quickly go through it, threat to status would be, I'm not promoting your status, I'm actually lowering it. Threat to certainty would be, hey, there's gonna be some changes, but I'm not telling you what they are. There's no transparency about what that is. Autonomy might be, I'm gonna put this person over the top of you and they're gonna make sure this all works great, right? So boom, autonomy, that's a massive threat. Relatedness, if I just feel like our relationship is poor or you have an interaction that's really curt with me and all of a sudden I feel uncomfortable, boom, my relatedness threat detector goes up. And fairness, right? Going back to institutional changes and, you know, change management, which is a beautiful way to trigger threat across every SCARF domain possible and take those through the roof, would be, oh, there's going to be some changes and we're going to do some reorg. And all of a sudden your fairness trigger goes, who's going to get rewarded and who's not going to be here after that and all of this? And how are you going to even think about how to make those decisions? So SCARF is this really powerful tool that I use either in the forefront or at least in the back of my mind to go, if these domains are being rewarded, we're in good space. If they're being threatened, we got some work to do. And so it just, it applies to so much.
All right, I'm going to do two scenarios for you. One is I'm a leader who has been involved in doing some sort of strategic planning for 2021 as we come out of this COVID pandemic. What is the world going to look like after that? We include going back to work, you know, there could be some structural changes, who knows what, but there's going to be some changes in order to survive and thrive in this post-COVID world, right? We're not going back to the way things were. What could I do as a leader to communicate those changes without setting off people's unconscious brain's ability to see it as a threat?
Yeah. So I think the first thing to just call out is it is a threat. Like, we're just in the mitigation phase of this, right? Change is a threat. We love our
any changes.
Yeah, we love habits. Yeah. We don't want to change it. We hate forming new habits because they're hard and all that. So ultimately, to actually answer your question, instead of dodge it like I was doing, I would say one, you from a status standpoint, you want to give them some control and some accolades around, we know you're the best at defining within the space that you're in the best path forward. So even though these are the changes that are coming, we're looking to all of you to actually inform that space up. So now all of a sudden,
include them in the planning, in a sense.
That's right. In a sense, even if they weren't in the room with the executives when this was happening, they're now in a sense in their own rooms doing the more minutia level components of this.
And that's
going to elevate status. Right?
Would that be status and relatedness or?
Absolutely. It's status, relatedness, and autonomy. Right? Yeah. So this is a huge one for autonomy.
Yes.
So from a certainty standpoint, humans don't fill gaps in knowledge with positive things, right? Again, 5 times more threat detectors than reward detectors. So anytime there's a gap in my awareness of something, I'm going to fill it with the worst possible scenario, probably. It ruminate, and all of a sudden my productivity goes down for, let's say,
ever. Why I don't sleep well at night.
That's right. Yeah. And then my relationships go to heck too. So from a certainty standpoint, don't share something if you can't share transparency with it. Hmm. Right. So you want to share and you want it to be transparent, but sometimes we'll rush to share to say, oh, I'm being transparent because here's all these changes that are coming, but we don't know what it's going to look like in all of these ways, but we want you all to know. Well, that's an atomic bomb for certainty. So in a sense, it's like, here's what we're doing. Here's the plan. And the plan might not be the minutia, but the plan should be, here's the plan for creating the plan for the minutia. And here's how everybody's going to be able to understand and be updated at a regular basis through these processes.
So the plan could be, what I'm sharing with you is, we are working on a plan, it's not done yet, but you will find out it's the finished product by X date. I mean, sort of you creating structure and certainty okay, that makes perfect sense. I get that.
While you know you're blowing up certainty, you want to try to backfill as much certainty in other spaces as possible. So it could be certainty of, let's say it's likely that people are going to lose their jobs. Well, you don't want to say it's likely that people are going to lose their jobs because every single person in the organization is going to go, it's me. And here's why it's me.
Right. Right. Yeah.
They fill it. Right. So now you've just completely taken your whole organization offline. So create certainty where as much as you can. And it could be all of you are going to have input, and nobody's going anywhere. You know, we're not making any decisions about personnel or anything like that for this space of time. Or, you know, this is how that communication is going to go. And anybody that's let go is going to have an opportunity to navigate. And even if it's terrible and it's like, we are going to let people go, then you're going to say, here's all of the resources that we are providing to ensure that you transition seamlessly from the time you're told that you're going to be let go till the time that actually happens. We're going to do all of this work to ensure you're successful. So that's a worst case scenario, but now you've given me certainty. I'm not alone.
As much as you possibly can. I remember there was a guy that we were working with at a company who was in somewhat hot water. He was one of my coachees, and it was a bit of a, as they say, gnarly situation. But he needed to create certainty of his actions towards recovering the issues that he was so accused. Long story short, we said, really, it would be important for you to give your leadership an update, but don't just give them an update once in a while. Give them an update at a particular day. Like, it's always going to be on Friday. Yeah. And so even though he couldn't control everything, the team was going to go through its own thing, at least he was being consistent in terms of his communication. Yep. So he was adding to the certainty aspect that you're defining. And it actually became something that people relied on. And I think it raised his currency, if you will, in the company. I want to throw another scenario with you, Chris, here before we sort of wrap up. And this is not just about SCARF, but just in general, you know, your your background and all this information around neuroscience and this bridge that you've been able to be between education and industry. If you were to say, all right, I'm a leader of a team, but I've never been a leader of a team before. I've always been a really strong individual contributor. I've been a high flyer, as they may say, and now I've been rewarded. Oh, by the way, my status just went up, yay, to being a leader of a team of 20. I've never done it before, but now I've got that. Certainly, there's going to be some underlying baggage and concerns that might come into play with me. How might you work with me in that scenario? What could I be doing, not only for myself, but maybe for the team to get it established?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think this would be in addition to sort of the natural things that we go to within the business world about team dynamics and all of that. But if I go back to this kind of fundamental thing, the pieces that are tickling my brain are trust and motivation.
Okay.
So how do we maximize those two things as quickly as possible? So I don't know of any other way to get to trust without vulnerability. True, authentic trust without vulnerability, I just don't know if that's possible. And remember, trust is based on a relationship, not based on me trusting that you're good at what you do. That's not important as a social creature, like to an extent. So the first thing I would do is, how are you going to go and move people from in-group or from out-group to in-group? Because this is a new team. It's got a new leader. We need to build trust and we need to use vulnerability to do that. So I'm going to set that aside and I'm going to go into the motivation piece. So there's some magical research around this in the psychology and neuroscience spaces that say, if you can create a team identity, which you can do very simply, it's shockingly simple, and I'll explain what I mean in a second, you can overcome differences that are incredibly challenging in terms of outgroups, right? It goes beyond, you know, it can bring people together that might have racial tensions or other marginalized sort of intersections. There can be a historical challenge between people, you know, over 15 years. Yeah. And doing the grouped identity will maximize that. So the first thing you do is give the group a name, give it a clear identity and make it unique and let them buy into that. I mean, that's like a 30-minute exercise.
But wait,
our name.
Chris, we're the marketing team. Is that what you mean?
No, because I think what you want is you want to feel like a unique sense of identity within the group, because the more unique it is, the more it sort of coalesces all of these other magical things that happen and follow downstream.
So we would name ourselves versus this
That's
just
right.
becoming a function of somebody else's org chart that we are now on.
You got it.
We are actually going to call ourselves something. I mean, not to the point where we say we are this and we wear t-shirts all over the place, but it could be. But you're saying create an identity, a name by those who are part of that group. And that creates community, that creates connection. So what other benefits come from that?
Yeah. So when I learned this, I mean, my head exploded because it's too simple, right? Here's what happens when we coalesce into a team. And by the way, the research spans everything from business to kids going to camp, which is actually a great model for this, right? They're coming in from all over the place. You know, your little dorm has its own name and you're competing against other people. So the first thing that happens is people feel a strong affinity for each other almost immediately, right? Yeah, you got to work out some kinks, but for the most part, we have an affinity. We have a shared identity and a shared goal. In a sense, this might go back to the idea of being in a troop, you know, in small groups when we were, you know, earlier humans. The second thing is we become intensely more empathetic to each other merely by the fact that we formed this in-group. So we're always more comfortable being empathetic to our own team, right? Like we yell at the ref when they call something against us. And then every time they call it against the other team, we're like, yeah, you're right. Right. So And that's going both directions. So empathy goes up. And then the other thing is that we're eager, so much more eager to actually make sacrifice for the other individuals within the team and defend them, which like, it's a crazy that all this stuff comes in to the point where even if it's another team member that shines, we share, we actually cognitively receive that as if we are winning ourselves. Right. And so what this does is it really shifts from this. So what are the implications of this? One, boom, a few sessions and you're off and running. We would do some nuancy stuff in terms of those facilitations. But two, think about how we reward, right? So this would be the last piece I think about teams. We almost always do individual rewards in, right. in business.
Right.
Right. And academia is, I mean, horrendous at this, right? Even if you're in a group project, everybody gets an independent grade, like which is challenging from a real world standpoint.
Right.
So the key is you reward group success. You reward the group achieving goals. And when that happens, magic happens. Everybody lifts each other up and they have a sense of connection. Yeah. So there's, it's tapping into an intrinsic motivator set in the brain as well as the extrinsic, right? Because there's a sense of competition, like, oh, we're this team. We're going to be better than all the other teams, right? And now it's not competition within the social groups of the team. It's shocking how simple that is, but that's just one of those integrated professional development things where I'm like, I got to start with this before I get to all of the management models and the five dysfunctions of the team and the you know, Tuckman model of storming, norming, and all of that.
Exactly. No, this is great. I mean, there's so many basic, simple things that are actionable. I want to call out some of this stuff that you said was this ability to reverse the sequence of dealing with issues that we know are going to come. Let's deal with them front end. What are some of the barriers we may be running into first and foremost, and then talk about them? I know there's his last name was Klein, who was talking about, like, instead of a postmortem, do a premortem, you know, think ahead. What could we run into? Not just in terms of like resources and so forth, but what are some of the emotional barriers that we might be running into individually or even as a team? I think that's great. Yep. So that when they come up, we sort of already begun to deal with them. And I love the idea of naming the team, giving it an identity. I think about how we are so familiar with that with sports, like the Packers versus the Vikings and so forth. And we have affinity, even though we may have moved out of that area. I still follow the Vikings and I haven't lived in Minneapolis for years. I still feel sort of a team connection to that, right? I think that's a great idea to being able to translate that into work. And then, you know, being able to, of course, reward team activity, not just individual activity. Great points, Chris. Really cool. So listen, as we finish up here, how can people, as I've told everybody in the introduction, you know, you're part of the MFI team, you're the VP of Learning and Development, but how can people connect with you around this topic and you individually? Where do we send people?
Yeah, so I think, you know, obviously to, you know, Mission Facilitator website where, you know, I have a little bit of a bio and my contact information is there. Also to LinkedIn, you know, I like to share articles and things like that as they come up. For the most part, there's two kind of halves to this, right? I make my living doing this with companies and academic institutions, but this is also just, it's just so freaking fun that ultimately when someone tells me a problem, they're like, hey, here's our problems. I get giddy, right? Like, this is why we do the work. We get giddy about it. And then I start thinking through what are the fundamentals. And so, you know, even if someone's just going, is there anything there? What might we be missing? Yeah, let's have a conversation. Let's drink a virtual coffee until we can do it in person. And explore. And of course, if people have ideas that I didn't mention, of course, there's probably hundreds that I didn't think of. I would love to hear them. So yeah, please reach out.
I want to end on one other thing that you've been saying many times during this interview was around fundamentals. And what that to me translates is, let's don't take a look at just the symptoms. Let's look at the source. Let's get down to the meat of what is really running the show. And it's not just our actions, but maybe what's going on subconsciously that is sort of the fuel for whether we're successful or not. And I think that's one of the things that you bring among many things as one of your truly brilliant skills is being able to deconstruct down to the source, because that's where change happens. So, hey, thank you so much for being on the show. And of course, you know, as a good friend and as a good partner in our company, I look for many, many more of these and more time exploring this great topic.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dean. This was great.
Thank you for listening to The Business of Intuition. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about Dean or Mission Facilitators Leadership, go to mfileadership.com. That's mfileadership.com.